Kate, sorry for the delay there. I want to thank all of you. Stay with me. I see the time now is usually when I finish, so I must have finished the lecture already. I must have given the lecture without noticing it. I hope you all laugh at that. Okay, now today I want to conclude the, I'm going to give a lecture. First I want to go over what I think is the basic theme in Rand's ethics. And then we'll also discuss an issue involving rights that Rand takes a very distinctive view on that many libertarians today are interested in, namely intellectual property. And this actually, one reason I decided to talk about this is that this plays a rather important role in Atlas Shrugged, because the patents that the inventors, various inventors have, are very important in the novel. And then after we go over this part on right, I want to go into, I think, very important in understanding Rand's philosophy, is what the objectivist views on foreign policy, particularly on the morality flora. So those are some things we'll be talking about in the lecture today. Okay, now, one thing we were mentioning last time, it's a crucial point in understanding objectivist ethics, is that although objectivism is a type of ethical egoism, it's a non-standard kind of egoism. What do I mean by that? Well, an egoist view of morality is one that says what you're trying to do in morality, the purpose of morality is to advance your own interests. There are various kinds of ethical egoism, but an ethical egoist view says what morality is for is what's good for me. It's not, so this is a view, of course, that many moralists oppose. In fact, there's some moralists who define morality to consist of duty to others. So an egoist view says, no, morality is concerned with what's good for me. But the distinctive, or a distinctive part of the objectivist view of ethical egoism is that it does not at all follow from that view, namely that it's an ethical egoist view, that you're free to disregard the interests of others. So this is an apparent paradox, because supposing you say, well, here's somebody else over here who has certain goals that person wants. Why should I respect that person's goals? Or if they own certain property, why should I respect his property rights? Well, one answer some moral theories could give is that we have a duty to respect other people simply because other people are intrinsically important. But it seems an ethical egoist theory can't take that view, because the ethical egoist theory is saying that what's important in ethics is your own interest. So how could you say you have duties to other people if the egoist theory is that you, the person around you, promote your own life? But nevertheless, Rand and her followers among the objectivists say you do have to respect other people. You're not supposed to sacrifice yourself to others, but at the same time, you can't sacrifice other people to yourself. So you can't let other people use you, but you can't use other people. either. So it doesn't seem like a standard egoist point of view. So how do the objectivists get around this? And let's make sure we understand what the problem is. The objectivists want to say we ought to respect the interests and rights of other people, but at the same time, objectivists are ethical egoists who say the purpose of morality is for each person to advance his or her own interests. So how do they those views appear to be in tension, so how do they get around that? What is their explanation? How do they reconcile those two apparently competing imperatives? So what they say is, and this is kind of the obvious but still ingenious way out, is they say it's in each person's interest to respect the rights and interests of other people. So supposing, say, I see you walking along, I know you're very well off and you have a lot of money, I could just hit you over the head and you're not looking, just take all your money. So you might say, well, on an ethical egoist view, why shouldn't I do that? Why should I say that I ought to respect your property rights in the money or your freedom against physical assault? Why should I respect your rights? So the objectivist answer is that it's not in my interest to do that thing. And you might say, well, why not? Wouldn't I be getting the money? But the objectivist view is that people benefit by peaceful exchanges on the free market. This is very similar to Ludwig von Mises on social cooperation for the free market. So it isn't in my interest to treat other people simply as if they were there to be preyed upon, because we can all benefit by peaceful production exchanges with each other. So the basic point here is that in the objectivist view, there is a fundamental harmony of interests among people. So even though each person is trying to promote his or her own happiness or his or her own interests, it's in each person's interest to respect other people as well, not to live off others as parasites or not to take advantage of people. So that's the basic way the objectivists answer this apparent paradox, where they say both that they're ethical egoists and that they should respect the rights of others. So the question obviously comes up, is what they're saying plausible? Is there, in fact, a basic harmony of interest among people? Well, it appears that they certainly have a strong case that again, Mises makes his point that people benefit through cooperation on the free market, and it's very desirable to preserve this great social system where we each respect other people's rights and then we benefit from peaceful exchanges. But a problem that the objectivists have that Mises doesn't have, because he doesn't make such a far-reaching claim as they do, is that they want to claim unless you have an emergency situation, you can never benefit from violating the rights of others. And what do we mean? I'll just say, briefly, I'm not going to go into this in great length, but what do we mean by an emergency situation? Well, let's suppose we're on a ship and the ship goes overboard and there's a lifeboat and there's just one place left on it. And we're both swimming for the lifeboat. So obviously there my interest is in direct conflict with yours because we each would want to survive, but there's only one place available. So that's a clear case where there's a conflict of interest between us, there's not a harmony of interest. But the judge would say, well, that kind of case just happens in emergencies, in the normal course of events. People's interests are in harmony, so it's never, if we're in one of these normal situations, never in our interest to violate the rights of others. I should say just the kind of interest. In passage, you'll forgive me, one of my office jokes. There was a quotation from Thoreau that goes something like this: if I have unjustly taken a plank from a drowning man, I must restore it to him, though I drown myself. So I once suggested changing this to, if I have unjustly taken a plank from a drowning man, I must restore it to him, unless I drown myself. Now, when I said that, it was just as a joke, but that actually would be the objectivist view, that you have to respect other people's rights, unless there's some emergency where people's rights come into conflict. So a problem with this view is that it seems like there's some non-emergency situation where you could benefit by violating the rights of others. There's a famous example that John Hosford gives, the bank embezzler case, where someone works for a bank, and the bank clerk, the teller, the clerk, and he sees a way he could just do something and steal a lot of money, maybe to make some electronic transfers, and he would just take a lot of money. And he's very skilled, he would never be found out, he never does it again. And then he lives happily ever after on the proceeds. So it's, now if people generally did that, then things wouldn't work out well. But supposing, why should that stop him from doing it in this case? So it seems like you could come up with examples like this where there isn't a harmony of interest. Now, of course, you could say, you could just define any case of an apparent disharmony as an emergency situation and say, Rand says there's a harmony except for emergency situations. But that wouldn't be, that would just make the thesis vacuous. Then you could just say there's a harmony of interest except when there isn't. So we have to have kind of a clear sense there's definite emergencies, like you're going to have one person's life in conflict with another. But if you don't have those, then the objectivist view is that there is this harmony of interest. So then the objection is there appear to be cases where there aren't. Now, as I mentioned last time, I don't think Rand is too successful in the way she tries to escape this objection, that she just says, well, in the embezzler case, the person would always be found out. He'd always get very nervous about being found out. He'd always have to come up with new stories on explaining anomalies and so on. But it seems like she's just telling the story so it'll come out her way. Of course, she was very good at telling stories, but it doesn't follow from the skill of the fiction writer that things would always work out the way she said. Now, what I want to spend some time now is dealing with another response, an objectivist response to this sort of case that I think is somewhat better than what Rand said, which is the person would always be found out. So remember, it's a little complicated, but we have to always keep in mind what I like to call the dialectical situation. We're going to tell us that we have first, Rand is both an egoist and someone says we have to respect the rights of others. How are those two principles to be reconciled? By saying there's a basic harmony of interest among people. And then the objection is, what about cases where there appears not to be a harmony of interest? And now we want to deal with one objectivist response to that, which is that in this kind of case, the embezzler is living a lie or faking reality. And what is meant by that? Well, the embezzler, let's imagine the embezzler is doing an investigation. Somebody says, you're missing all this money. You might think about it. You say, no. So he's not accurately reporting reality. He's giving a false picture of the world. Of course, he's in effect living a lie. So this answer is that a reason you wouldn't really be gaining from violating the rights of others is that if you did that, you'd be living a lie. Now, I think there's a problem with this response. Is it certainly one thing that's right about this stuff? It's certainly in your own interest to have a correct perception of reality, at least usually. So you wouldn't want to be living a lie in the sense that you have the wrong perception of reality. It isn't, say, a good idea. It isn't a good way to live your life, say, to think you're the Emperor Napoleon if, in fact, you aren't the Emperor Napoleon. Now, there are some cases where my friend, late friend Bob knows it, used to give examples, where it might not be true that it's in your interest to have a correct perception of reality. For example, supposing someone does better than he otherwise would because he overrates his own ability. Let's say the person he's a professor of economics at some university, and he's actually not all that great a professor. He can do a competent job. He's not all that great. But he thinks he's one of the world's top economists, and thinking that just gives him a lot of confidence, and he does better work than he would if he didn't think that. So here we have a case where the person thinks that has an incorrect perception of reality, but that helps him do better than he would otherwise. So this is a counter example of the claim that in your own interest have a correct perception of reality. I'll tell you one funny story about that. One person who wrote on this theme was a former student of Noah's named Martin Seligman, who wrote a book called Learned Optimism, which more or less suggested if you take a somewhat better view of yourself and it's really justified, you'll do better than you would if you were completely realistic. So I said to Nozick, maybe if you thought you'd benefit from the book, maybe that would show you wouldn't need it. And he immediately responded, maybe that's a borderline case. But I'm just mentioning this just to kind of put this aside, because let's assume the bank embezzler isn't one of these exceptions. And we can say, in most cases, it does seem it's in your interest to have a correct perception of reality. So we want to ask now, is this a good response to the objection that we don't have a harmony of interest, because sometimes you can benefit from violating the rights or interests of others, that if you did that, you'd be faking reality? Here, what I think the problem is, fundamental problem, is that it's certainly in the interest of the embezzler to be aware that he's stolen money. He wouldn't want to be somebody just acquired the money in a fit of absence of mind. And it's also in the interest of other people that they be aware of his crime. Say the owners of the bank or the bank officials would certainly like to know about it. But why is it in the interest of the embezzler to assist others to a better perception of reality when this would have bad consequences for them? So the objectivist is saying, well, this embezzler and people in similar cases are faking reality, but they're assuming that it's to everybody's advantage to have a correct perception of this reality. Just the question would be, why is it in the interest of the embezzler that other people be aware of what he's done? That's just the same question of the harmony of interest, which was up for discussion. So I think the objectivist response here is begging the question, because the objectivist response was supposed to be answering the point, there appear to be some cases where there isn't a harmony of interest among people, and then they say, well, in those cases, there's some faking reality, but then just what they're assuming is that it's in everybody's interest not to fake reality, but that just assumes the thesis of the harmony of interest, which is supposed to be proven. I hope you're not all confused by that. I am, but I hope you are. Now I want to turn to, I say that's what I think is a general problem of Inland's ethics. But I now want to turn to a particular issue that's involving rights, not on why people should observe the rights of others, but particularly issues held about rights that many libertarians are interested in today. That's their intellectual property. And Rand strongly supported patents and copyright. Patents gives you the right to prevent other people from copying an invention that you come up with. Copyright would be something like on a book or a piece of music that would prevent people from reproducing it without your permission. And you'll remember patents play a big role in Atlas. The State Science Institute, which is a very bad group, wants to control all inventions, and the government wants inventors to sign over their patents to the government. Of course, these people, the heroes in Atlas Shrugged, don't want to do that, but the state wants them to. So, obviously, if patents aren't, if copyrights aren't justifiable, that would poke a big hole into the plot of Atlas Shrugged, because then the government could say to the people, to the inventors, you have no special right to keep your invention to yourselves in the sense of preventing other people from copyrighting. So instead of saying, well, you have to turn over your patents to us, they could just say, well, all patents are illegitimate. If that were right, it would really knock out the whole plot of Atlas Shrugged. So it's essential for the plot of the book, or at least that a good part of the plot, that patent be legitimate. Now, how did Rand attempt to justify patents and copyrights? Well, remember, we were discussing this a little bit the last time, that according to her, property rights arise from your freedom of action. So each person is creating values which are things you act to gain or keep. A value to Rand is something that you act to gain or keep. So in the case of ideas, Rand thinks that because an inventor has come up with a new idea, say Edison, the idea of an electric light bulb, so he's created it, and this gives him a property right. So the idea is kind of expression of his freedom of action. If he hadn't come up with the idea of the electric light, then we'd all have to be watching television by candlelight. So he came up with this new idea, so that's why he has a property right. Now, you might immediately object that only physical objects can be old, not ideas. It's kind of, I'm sure if you're familiar with the anti-IP literature, say by Stefan Kinsella, who's a legal theorist, who's written a critical intellectual property, is the basic point he makes. It. Well, you can only own physical objects, not ideas. But Rand wouldn't have denied that. She wouldn't have said, well, when Edison just had an idea of a light bulb, that was enough. He would have to come up with at least some sort of physical device or a blueprint for a physical device. And similarly, a copyright holds, applies to a physical object, such as a book or an article. So in her view, you'd actually have to come up with some sort of physical object. Say, this is what I want a patent on. So it isn't, you can't just say to her, well, look, you can't own just ideas. You can only own objects. Because she would say, that, I agree with that. You can only own objects, and the patents apply to them. And if you hold a patent, you can't forbid others from talking about what you invented. What the prohibition is, that other people can't make copies of your physical device. So in her view, you get the physical device, you own a certain physical device, but that's an expression of your freedom of action. And then once you don't own an idea, just as some kind of ethereal floating abstraction, you own the actual physical device. And once you've got that, you can forbid other people from copying the physical device, not talking about what you've done. Now, one thing to notice, this is not an objection to what she's saying, but one thing to notice, it's very important not only for getting her views on intellectual property, but understanding her whole view of it, that when she talks about value, she's using the word value in a different way from the one that's customary in Austrian economics. Remember, in Austrian economics, we talk about subjective value, which is you're constructing a preference scale, possible actions or things that you want. Supposing you have a choice, say, between vanilla and chocolate ice, you say, well, I prefer vanilla to chocolate and chocolate to strawberry. I'm constructing a preference scale based on my subjective preferences. The value in Austrian economics is subjective judgment of where something ranks in the preference scale. But the way Rand is using value, the value is an object. It's something you act to gain or keep. So to take my example, she would take the value to be the vanilla or the chocolate ice cream rather than the subjective ranking of those values in my preference scale. So value is an actual object. Now, getting back to intellectual property, and this point goes very much along with her emphasis on the fact that when you have a patent or a copyright, you're owning a physical object. She made a sharp distinction between inventions and discovery. In her view, you can't patent a law of nature, something that's out there to be found out. Say, Einstein, when he came up with the theory of relativity, couldn't take out a patent on it. He actually was working with a clerk in the Swiss patent office and published great papers in 1905 on specialties and activities, but he couldn't have taken out a, in her view, couldn't take out a patent on his own discovery, because according to her, new concepts are abstractions from perception. You don't create a physical law, you discover it, you just find out what's there in reality. So, as opposed to an invention, which is something you actually come up with, it's new, a discovery in her view, law of nature is just something that's really out there to be found out by abstraction from concept. So, as you can see, and it's very often, almost always the case in her philosophy, the theory of concepts is of primary importance. Now, in contrast to discoveries, what we're doing is abstracting from the physical world, we come up with concepts, and we combine concepts, come up with new concepts. An inventor is bringing into existence a physical object that wouldn't have existed without his action. So, the law of nature isn't something that the scientist has created, but invention is something that's created. So she thought there's a basic distinction there between discoveries and invention. Now, I think there's a problem with her view, is that when you, suppose you have a patent, she can certainly say you have to have a physical device, so you can't have a patent unless you can come up with some physical device, but you don't just own that if you have a patent. You have the power to prevent others from building an object that embodies your idea. So if, say, Edison had a patent on the electric light bulb, other people couldn't say, well, he doesn't own the idea of a light bulb, so why can't I just use his idea and make my own light bulb? But if he had a patent, I couldn't do that without his permission, at least if I wanted to sell my light bulb to others. But you could say, isn't the inventor's idea also based on abstraction from perception, if Rand's theory of concept is right? So if she's going to say discoveries of laws of nature, scientists like Einstein come up with new laws of nature, aren't entitled to patent what they come up with, because an idea isn't some new object that's created, it's just something set by abstraction from perception, then you have the problem, if you can prevent others from copying your idea, why can't the discoverer of new ideas prevent others from using their discoveries? It seems like, I tend to think this distinction she's making breaks down, because the inventor isn't just getting the right to control a particular physical device he's come up with, he's preventing others from using his ideas to come up with similar devices of their own. Now, there's another related problem, is it isn't clear really how Rand's argument for patents and copyright is supposed to go. Suppose that an inventor does create a new idea in the way she suggests. Why does it follow that other people should be prohibited from using this idea without his permission? So I suppose we get Edison again, he's come up with this idea for a light bulb, and he's made a light bulb. So why does it follow that other people can't come up with full light bulbs? They couldn't take his device and just take it away from him, or seize it and make copies of it without his permission. Why couldn't they just Once they grasp the idea, build their own why thoughts. Once they get the formula, why can't they do it as well? It isn't clear what the argument's supposed to be there. Now, it might be in the inventor's interest that others not be allowed to use his idea without his permission. Say, again, let's get back to Mr. Edison. Once he's invented a light bulb, if other people can just build their own, isn't he going to get a lot less money than than he would if he could just prevent others from making light bulbs without having to pay him a fee or negotiate with him for permission? But why, supposing it is in his interest that others not be able to use his idea without his permission, why do other people have an obligation to do what's in the inventor's interest? So why can't these other people say, well, sure, it would benefit you if we have to pay you to use your new invention, but why should we care about that? And I think this is a general instance of a problem for the objectivist theory of rights, because the objectivists say certain things are in our interest, say, to have property rights or to engage in productive labor, but it doesn't follow that other people have an obligation to respect our interests in those things. So there's a general jump in objectivist theory from, say, people have an interest in certain things, it's to their advantage to do certain things, to say that they have a right to those things, which for a right means that other people have a duty not to interfere with them. Now we could ask further questions, is it in fact in the inventor's interest to have patents? You might think the obvious answer is yes, or we could ask the related question. Is it in the interest of most people that inventors get protection for their invention? Obviously, it's not in the interest of competing people who have come up with similar ideas themselves that they have to pay fees to inventors. But is it in most people's interest if they're say there are a lot more inventors because they're benefiting from patent protection? So is it in most people's interest to have patents? This is a point that invites kind of an empirical issue, but Rothbard and Mankind State and the two economists, Michelle Holdren and David Levine, a book called Denton's Electoral Monopoly, challenge this view, and they say, well, look, people actually do very well without patents and copyrights. We still get a lot of inventions. You might at first not think so, but it works out that you do. one further problem before I turn from this topic is that with Rand's view of patent is that she thinks that patent protection should extend only a certain number of years, not forever. And the limit, say, for a certain number of years, takes account of the fact that often many people are working on a new invention at the same time. They often find that, when Alexander Graham Bell was working on the telephone, there were other people around the same time. With radio, with a lot of people were working on radio. When Marconi's given credit for radio, but the British physicist Oliver Lodge was also working on for roughly the same time at various legal facts. In fact, there was a friend of mine, who is a sociologist, F. Collins in a film, wrote in a book called The Sociology of Invention, came out in the 1930s, and he had a number of cases like this of people working on the same invention at the same time. So Rand thought, because of this fact that patent protection should be limited. And also, she thought that, remember, it's basic and persistent, that people need to do productive work, and she thought perpetual patents would encourage parasitism. So if you come up with some really great invention, then you'd be tempted not to work anymore, but just to live off your patent. But even if what she says is true, there are these simultaneous, there's a lot of simultaneous inventions, or roughly simultaneous inventions, and there's the danger of parasitism. Why should this limit the inventor's right if, in fact, the inventor has a genuine right? So it seems like Rand is asking what would be good for the inventor rather than what he has a right to in a way that doesn't apply to other rights. You don't generally say, well, say you have a right to your bodily integrity. We don't say you only have this right if you use it to your own good, say you. You don't have a right to smoke because that would be bad for you. So, but here she seems to be saying, well, you're limited in your patent protection because if you have more extended rights, that might not be good for you. Now, I now want to, with time left, I want to say address another very controversial issue Rand thought a lot of interest to libertarians is what were her views on foreign policy. Well, she didn't write a great deal on foreign policy. Before Pearl Harbor, she was a non-interventionist, I think. She was among those who thought that after Germany and the war with France and England, Britain and France declared war on Germany September 3rd, 1939, after the German invasion of Poland September 1st. Most people, of course, in the U.S. were very anti Nazi, and she was as well, but she was among those who thought that the U.S. shouldn't get involved in the war, and of course this, when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Russia, June 20, 1941, she continued in that war. She certainly didn't want to help the Russians. So, in fact, she supported, in the 1930 election, she supported the Republican candidate, Wendell Willkie, who was at least claimed to be a non-interventionist, although in fact he wasn't. So she was like the group, she was really associated with the group that Murray Rothbard called the old right, who tended to be non-interventionist in foreign policy. Now, after World War II, though, her views shifted somewhat, and she supported the Cold War, which was the U.S. struggle with the Soviets and their allies, and she was very strongly pro-Israel in Mideastern matters. But foreign policy really wasn't her specialty. However, some of her followers, such as Leonard Peacock and Yaron Rook, the Ayn Rand Institute, had more to say on this topic, and I think their views are of some interest. Now, one of the most important statements of objectivist foreign policy is in a book, which I think is generally a very good book, by C. Bradley Thompson, but it has one chapter which was written by Yaron Rook, called Neoconservatism, an obituary for an idea. So what the view in this book, especially in the chapter on foreign policy, which is written by Yaron Brook, is that just as an individual should live by the morality of rational egoism, a nation should do that also. So how you get the appropriate foreign policy value applies at the legalist philosophy will give you the answer to that. So what he's saying is you just apply the same principles that you would in ordinary life for individuals to nations, and you'll come up with the right results for foreign policy. Now, you might think that this prescription for foreign policy, where you say what the appropriate foreign policy is for a nation, analogous to what appropriate actions are for individuals, you might say this is a fallacy because nations really aren't individuals. It would make sense for an individual to defend himself against attempt by others to violate his right, but can we talk about a nation defending itself in the same way? Isn't this assuming a nation is sort of some super individual? And of course, it isn't. A nation is nothing apart from the individuals that compose it, that are in it, and they're in various relations with one another. But the objectors, I think, would have a good answer if one were to give this object. And they could just say they're just talking about the rights of a group of individuals, and they aren't assuming that nations exist in some further collectivist sense. So they could say, no, we're not saying that the nation is a kind of super group or super organism. It's just we talk about groups of associated individuals, and you ask what policy should this group pursue, we get this by applying the same principles that we do in the term of what individuals should do. Now, one point I want to go into before I get to the objectors' foreign policy themselves is they have, and you'll find in this book I just mentioned by Rabbi Thompson, they have some very good criticisms, I think, for neoconservatives. And they have, as you'll see, it's a reputation for supporting aggressive foreign policy. You'll see shortly it's a well-deserved reputation. But they have some good criticisms, nevertheless, of the neoconservatives. Now, the neoconservatives think we should support democratic revolutions all over the world. So the neoconservatives said they favored invading Iraq in 2003 because they said, well, look, Iraq is under the brutal tyranny of Saddam Hussein, so we ought to help the people there liberate themselves from this tyrant and establish a decent democratic machine. So what do the objectivists have to say against that? Well, say that's altruism, because in this, what we're doing, according to the neoconservatives, we're promoting democracy because we think it would be good for these other people. These other people are under the yoke of tyranny, and we're there to liberate them. But they say, no, we don't have any moral obligation to promote democracy or human rights in other countries. If we do that, we're sacrificing ourselves to help other people. This is altruism. We don't do this. It goes against the basic principle of objectivist morality. Now, the neocons might respond. They might say, well, no, their policy isn't altruistic in the sense that we're sacrificing our own interests just to help other people. They could say, it's in our interest to establish democracies in all these countries because democratic nations don't go to war with each other. So it's in our interest to start all these wars to ensure peace. And the slogan I think Charles Beard used to give when he was making fun of some of perpetual war for perpetual peace. There is what's called democratic peace theory. Democracies don't go to war with each other, so we should go in and try to establish democracies worldwide and ensure peace. But it doesn't seem to be the case that democracies don't go to war with each other. For example, the Palestinians elected the Hamas government, and they're certainly at war with Israel. And we doesn't seem at all that just if we have a government that the democratic government that's going to ensure peace, doesn't seem that is much behind that. If democracy just means majority rule, is that really such a good thing? Don't we really care about the government that's properly limited, ideally no government at all? Why should the fact that a majority support a certain government be sufficient reason to favor it? So I think this democratic peace theory doesn't have to be much to be said for it. So now I have a question though. Both of the objectors reject neocons foreign policy, but look, these neoconservatives want to spread democracy all over the globe, but that's altruistic. We don't want to do that. So in what way is their own foreign policy aggressive? What they would say is, look, just as an individual has the right to defend himself against other people from attacking him, does the nation have the right to defend itself? So can't we say, if other nations are threatening us, we defend ourselves, don't we have a right to do that? That isn't an aggressive foreign policy, that's a defensive foreign policy. But there's some big problems with that view. One is that in this view that Leonard Peikoff and Yaron Brook have, is once a nation thinks it's under threat, then it can do anything it thinks is needed to repel the threat. For example, suppose the U.S. today thought that Iran's program to acquire atomic weapons, if in fact they have such a program, might lead to an attack on us, we would be justified in launching to prevent a nuclear attack on them. So it isn't, say, we're thinking, well, look, we have evidence the Iranians have this nuclear weapon they're going to launch against us, and we're going to attack them first. No, if there's a possible danger that if they had such a weapon, they could use it on us, that justifies us in launching an attack on them. So it's very much that it's ostensibly a defensive foreign policy that says whenever we think there might be a threat, we can really do pretty much whatever we want to deal with it. So, again, I just want to emphasize this is a very extreme view, at least in the way I think of things. Again, what the view is that once something is perceived as a threat, the rights of anyone in the aggressor country lapse completely. Now, is this a plausible view? Well, suppose I'm giving a lecture, say not as I am now, just over the internet. Suppose I'm giving a lecture in a room as I did last month at the Mises Institute. And I have good reason to think there's someone in the room that's going to kill me. So I'm giving my lecture there at the Mises Institute. I find out there's a supporter of Stefan Molyneux in the audience. He doesn't like what I said about Molyneux. He's going to decide to execute me. So would I be justified in killing everyone in the room because there's a possible threat to me? So this ecolegalist view seems to imply that it would be, even though my hypothesis, everyone else except this person has nothing to do with attacking me, they're just in the room, but there's somebody there who I think is going to kill me, so I can just blast everybody whatever it would cost, because my own life is at stake. So that seems at least, to my way of thinking, a very extreme view. This objectivist view is very much in contrast with traditional just war theory. That in the traditional view, wars can be undertaken only under very strict conditions. For example, war has to be a last resort. You have to carry out the war with proper intentions. You're aiming only to remedy the cause of the war. Say, you can't say, well, our aim was defensive, but once we're in the war, we're going to really smash the other side. You can only carry out the war just to meet, only to meet what the proper, the justified cause was. And the force you're using has to be proportional to the threat. The objectivist view would reject all those requirements. The exceptionist view is, well, once you have a threat, then you can really do whatever you want. And again, another point is that's very different from the traditional view is the traditional view is not on just war, is not only on when you're justified in going to war. It's called jus ad bellum. But there's also restriction on what you can do once you're in the war, jus in bello. So you can't attack, a direct attack on non-combatants. So you can't say, well, okay, we're in a justified war with Nazi Germany, so we can just start bombing all the civilians as long as the war is justified. So the traditional just war view would say, no, you can't do that. You can never directly attack a non-combatant. And the objectivists don't recognize those limits. They say the civilians are at least partially responsible for their government. And in any case, if your life is at stake, then anything goes. So the last point I want to mention, again, how aggressive this sort of policy would turn out in practice would depend on how the objectivist assessed particular cases. I want to just conclude with raising the problem for this view is, suppose you accept ethical legalism, you say, suppose you accept the view that if my own life is at stake, then I can really do anything I want to preserve it, because I would have an emergency situation, so I don't have to respect other people's rights. I think there's a problem not recognized by Brooke and Peacock and their followers in applying that view to nations. Yet one way of attacking is just to reject this universal approach. Say, well, so the just war approach, you have to follow certain rules. Regard that go against what the egoist position, say you have certain limits on what you can do. But now I want to say, well, even if you accept egoism, could you apply this to nation? Well, the thing that I think would limit this is that threats by one country to another are not very often, sometimes they are, but not very often, not existential in the sense that the lives of those in the threatened countries aren't safe. That's to say, what the objectivist is trying to do is draw an analogy between an individual whose life is threatened by another person, a nation that's threatened with invasion. But if one nation invades another, it doesn't follow the invading nation's going to get rid of all the people in the country invade. It might simply want to take over territory from the other. So egoism might not support objectivist foreign policy in those circumstances. So this has been kind of a lecture covering a number of different topics, both in the objectivist morality and IP and foreign policy, hope it hasn't been too confusing, then I now will go to the Q&A, and you can we'll have a rest of time for questions, and you can type either in the Q&A or in the chat that I'll leave open. Okay, so we have one from Wes here. Since Rand stipulates you have a right to sue self-interest only in a rational, lawful manner, how could you possibly speculate that Inventor is pursuing self-interest consistent with Rand's stipulation? That's a very good question, but you see, when you could just take Rand as saying, this is my position, either you're not allowed to pursue self-interest in this way, but then the question would be, could she can't just stipulate that it's always in your interest to respect the rights of others? You see, she wants to go beyond saying, look, I think you can pursue your self-interest with this proviso that you respect the rights of others. She thinks that respecting the rights of others is in your self-interest, just taken by itself, or science fraud, as they say. So it isn't that she's just taking this as a given that you can pursue your self-interest only when you respect other people's self-interest. She says following that really is in your self-interest, and that's the point we could raise an objection to. So, in fact, she didn't reply to Hospers. Remember, Hospers said, well, what about this case? The investor is taking this money, but nobody knows about it. And she didn't reply to him by saying, as you would be suggesting, look, I'm just stipulating that only action respects the rights of others is legitimate, so somebody who did this would just be investing money, would just be violating my theory. This isn't the case against me. She did claim that it wasn't really in the person's self-interest. I think she's going beyond the different approach you're suggesting. Now Nathan said, in the investor example, a very weak argument, it relies so heavily on a what-if scenario, it just assumes a lot. Well, again, it's a very good point, Rick, but you see, I guess you just have to, in thinking of the example, think how plausible do you find this scenario? Does it seem altogether implausible or even plausible at all that somebody, sometimes people do get away with stealing money or doing things like that? I must say, I don't think it's particularly implausible. I don't think that people always are caught to commit crimes. But, you know, if you do, then you're not going to find it so implausible. But, and then of course, if you say that, it relies on what if, it assumes a lot. Remember, her response also assumes a lot that the person would be already caught out. So, again, I think you're right. It's a good point that it's relying on certain assumptions, and you just have to judge how plausible you find those. Now, Bob says, would you care to share your insight into the character Ranger Danner's skill and how it fits into Rand's theme, especially since the recent discussion on non-initiative force in the realm gets faced? It can be retaliation with them before. Okay, of course, now he's the pirate who kind of robs and causes things. But I think very much he would view his activities as just responses to aggression by the government. So he wouldn't be saying, well, I can just go and act like a regular pirate and just take action against anyone I want. It's only against people who think that benefited or got government creditors, that he does this action. I think it does reflect what you're putting in. I mean, she had a certain strain in her personality where she would just respect, sort of admire people who would just act on their own, even though this didn't really run against some of the principles. I think she had this kind of Nietzschean strain, if you will, where you do what you want. You'll forgive me again for giving one of my bad jokes when you mentioned the pirate. I once saw a cartoon that showed an older pirate who was talking to a young pirate, and the young pirate had all on the same side. He had an eye patch, a hook, and a wooden leg. So the older pirate said to the young one, "You mean you're contemplating a career change just because of that little accident your first time out?" Now, Wes says, "I not interpreted Rand as promoting respect the rights of others, violating the rights of others unlawful, and has more to do with the position of respecting the rights of others." So I see, Wes, so what you're saying is you're not requiring her to say that she's respecting the rights of others, but just that you have to avoid violating the rights of others. Well, I was using respect just to mean not violating the rights of others. But if you prefer phrasing it that way, she's not just stipulating that you're to pursue your own interests so long as you don't violate the rights of others. She's making the substantive claim that violating the rights of others won't, except for emergency situations, advance your own interests. So that isn't a claim that can be settled just by stipulation. So the question would come up, could you, in certain cases, advance your own interests by violating the rights of others? But I wasn't, it's a good point to make, I wasn't intending to draw a distinction between failing to violate and respecting. Now, Nathan said, "I've always been confused by Rand's concept of personal beauty. Always seemed like she did not see it as subjective." Well, I think she wasn't one of those who would have said it's actually 19th century novelists who said beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I think what she thought was that beauty expressed certain values, say life-affirming values or values in accord with her philosophy. So the value, of course, she thought that the values are objectively true, namely not intrinsically true, but objectively true in the sense that they could be established by reason, so that beauty would be an expression of the correct values. And it is interesting, I think in Atlas Shrugged, the characters that she admires, like Hank Reardon, John Galt, Danny, are portrayed as physically attractive, and the villains, Wesley Mouch or Mooch, are not attractive. So she tends to associate very much physical attractiveness and value. I see one from Alex. Do our judges believe in flying conversion to the war, or just flying will receive threats from the sign of the earth itself? Well, the objectivists haven't written very much on the Civil War. I don't think it's an official position. But there was a book published recently by an objectivist historian, Lewis, I think is the last name, who seemed very sympathetic to the Northern policy, likes General Sherman, who said this is the appropriate strategy. You know, he said, well, once you're in a war, you can do what you want. I think objectivists who strongly like Abraham Lincoln, Holzer, I think there's an attorney for Rand with Lincoln. So I don't think there's an official position on it. And Bob says, my son can only visit Paris for the children. There seems to be avoidance in that for sure. Well, I think there's a very interesting point that, I mean, Rand didn't have children of her own, and she seems not to. I don't think she had much interest in children. So I think that is something they tend not to emphasize much at this point. Now, Busby says, what do objectives say about the libertarian plan and aggressive foreign policy and American participation in World War I? And two, contribute immensely to expansion of domestic state power. Well, I don't think they would have to deny that. It isn't one they stress very much, although Rand might have, probably would have gone along with it at least before, in the years before World War II. But I think they would think afterward that, again, the Cold War, in their view, was legitimate, so they'd say, remember, they believe in a limited government, not a anarchism, so they would say defense is one of the proper functions of the government. So they would say if the government is pursuing the correct defensive strategy, which in their view can be quite aggressive, as I tried to bring out in the lecture, they would think that legitimate. Now Nathan says, I've read Mises' later language during that and shrugged, did you ever write about human action? Well, what she did, she had in her copy of Human Action, she had marginal notes on it. There's a volume, I think, edited by Robert Mayhew called Rand's Marginalia that has notes on Human Action. She was appreciative of Mises' economics, but she was rather critical of his philosophy, which she thought was too much influenced by Kant and too subjective. She sometimes has rather odd points. She noticed in one point that one Mises refers to the law of demand and supply instead of supply and demand. I think she thought that was a bit suspicious, but I'm not sure why. But she I think that was her principal writing on Human Action, was in marginal notes. Well, I should mention, since you refer to Human Action, the next course I'm going to be giving for Mises Academy, Danny Sanchez told me he's planning a series of courses on Human Action, and I'm going to be giving the one on the first part of Human Action, and we'll have economists like Joe Saloon and Guido Hilton giving courses on the later parts of the book. So that'll be my next course, I think. The first time I checked out Human Action, I read the first two pages and returned. I've since read it twice. Well, Nathan, do you mean you've read the whole book Human Action twice, or just the first two pages twice, your statement is ambiguous. Oh, that's very good. You read the whole book twice, that's remarkable. It's a long time. Now, let's say Rand may have disagreed with me, but I've heard Yaron Brook say complimentary things about music. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Do you know what he said? I didn't know that. I actually gave the book by Thompson Brook, I gave it a very favorable review, you know, which is not that usual for me, so I hadn't known that, I mean, from what I've seen of Brook, he seems like a very intelligent person. I think his views on foreign policy are wrong, but he seems like a very intelligent person, but I'd be interested in what he said about the institute. I see. So I think the only challenge would be a bank robber would be inclined to justify the government himself rather than feel sorry or worse. Well, that very well may be. I think that in all the banks I've robbed, I have felt sorry or worried. And you could come up with all sorts of cases, like the one person just took a memory pill. They erase the memory of what he's done. You know, they're very imaginative philosophers who can come up with all sorts of good cases. One of the things that I consider me to be such a fascinating person, biography that is like a feature in the film. Well, that's a very plausible view. Yes, one would like to see a movie about me. Of course, his wife was an actress herself. She was a dramatic actress, Margaret von Meese. I never met her. I saw her once. She was at a conference and party for a dinner for Marie Rothbard's 50th birthday in 1986. That was the only time I saw her. So Jimmy, I retired as president and CEO, kept employing for 42 years. We teach a course on Atlas Shrugged at the University of Arkansas. My first class was yesterday. Oh, that's interesting, Lester. You're giving your own course on the subject. Well, it would be nice to give being your course too, help you didn't find my course all that bad. And how did your first class go? Okay, Bob has to go. All right, well, thank you, Bob. Thanks for all your help in the classes. Oh, that's good. I'm glad the class went well. It's interesting to get a class online, right? I guess now with the election, the alleged influence of Rand on Paul Ryan, there's going to be more interest in the topic. Now, Nathan, in all talks with libertarian objectives, I think that IP rights are the one I can receive out publicly the most. People get real mad. I hear them maybe fired from my engineering position. Well, now I guess it's probably not a good idea to talk about them. I mean, it is surprising. You know, it generates all sorts of arguments. It wasn't that big an issue until fairly recently, I think. I mean, there were people who wrote about it, but I don't think it attracted all that much attention before, but a lot of people think it's an extremely important topic. It's not one I find absolutely central myself, but a lot of people do. Now, as Nathan says, is it true that Mickey Mouse is a real driver in the continuation of some IP rights? That one, I don't know. I'll have to Donald Duck that question to tell it no. Russ says, of course, in some time in many reasons. And by the way, I'm not an objective firm believer in the free enterprise. But, well, we agreed on that. Now, Russ says, I read Nozick's article on Rand, it was tough. But yes, I see the thing in reading Nozick is very different from many authors. That a lot of authors will give you, say, what their central thesis is, and then they'll explain it and try to keep going over what they said. Nozick doesn't do that, just throws one argument after another, so, and he spoke that way. He was an extraordinarily bright person. He expected readers to be able to figure out what he had in mind, so you have to be, I think you're right, not the easiest writer to follow, but I think he's certainly worth very careful study. As I mentioned before, you know, I knew him for 20 years. I made many talks with him. It really toughened me up in putting philosophy arguments. I highly recommend you read as much Nozick as you can. And I highly recommend. Thank you, Nathan. It's very kind of you to say that. Maybe. Well, thank you. It's always nice to get people who like my course. Well, all right, I guess we're about out of time now. So, again, I'm sorry for the delay in starting the lecture, and I want to thank all of you for coming to my course. I hope we'll see many of you here for my next course on the first part of human action. And I was saying to Danny Sanchez when he suggested the idea, I suggested a theme they could use in advertising the course, which was if you think the first part of human action is incomprehensible, you'll be sure that it's incomprehensible after you take my course, but maybe that wouldn't be the best way to advertise the course. Okay, well, thanks everybody. So thanks for being in the course, and we'll hope to see you again soon. Bye, everybody. Mm-hmm.